It's still good morning. We'll move forward with the Health Sciences meeting. If everyone would take a seat, please. All right, we will move forward. 11:56, starting the Health Sciences System Committee meeting. Carrie, if you would please take roll.
Chair Goodman.
Here.
Vice Chair Brigger.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo.
Here.
Regent Fernandez. Regent McGrath.
Here.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, Washo, the Numu, the Northern Paiute, the Niue, Western Shoshone, and the Niuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada. I'll now move forward with agenda item one, public comment. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter the meeting ID 992-8475-3091 and passcode 555-555. Is there any public comment at GBC? Going to take
no
that.
Public comment at GBC.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
None in Reno.
Thank you, Regent Arascada. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas? Seeing none, we'll move on. SES, is there any public comment on the phone?
No callers at this time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, item number two for possible action. The committee will consider approval of the September 4th, 2025 meeting minutes. Do I have any commentary or a motion?
Motion for acceptance.
We have a motion for approval from Regent Brager. Do I have a second?
Second, Regent McGrath.
Second.
Okay, we'll take that from Regent McGrath. Thank you so much. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes.
Aye. Oh,
thank you, Regent Del Carlo. I'm going to give you an extra minute because it sounds like you're a little delayed. Okay, so
thank
now
you.
We'll move to the chair's report. You know, I promised when I started as the chair of this committee that I wanted to have items that had some teeth, that we didn't just kind of, you know, fluff everything, that we actually talked about things and together as a system and as institutions and the board worked through issues. And so today, I think this will be an example of us having a robust conversation about some of the things that are floating out there and, you know, just really talking about maybe some issues that aren't really anyone's fault but are out there, bringing a little sunlight onto it all and having a great discussion and then being able to move forward. I think that sometimes there can be a culture of fear, and I don't like it. And so if we can basically talk about everything and move forward, then we're going to be better off. So I'm thrilled about our items that we're going to be hearing today and the conversation that we're going to be having. I did want to mention that pursuant to the presentation that was done by our International Gaming Institute at UNLV, there has been some movement where the NC2A may very well implement a CEU, which is a course to learn something that would apply nationwide, and this course would be implemented and just as a recommendation and as a tool to all athletic departments across the country. And that is just pursuant to the presentation that we had here back in, I think it was December, and in this Health Sciences Committee in the previous, I believe, June. So things are happening, and wouldn't that be amazing if with prediction markets and sports betting and phones, if we helped out all of our college athletes and were able to say, hey, you know, this you're not weak, and there's a huge stigma around this, and if you have a problem, you can get help, and it'll just be really a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. So that's really incredible, and I like it when things happen. So that's it for my comment. I'm not going to take the whole 5 minutes. We'll get 2 minutes and 40 seconds back, and now we'll move forward. My dear friend, Dr. Marcia Turner, who is the NCHE Associate Vice Chancellor for Health Sciences, she is going to talk to us about this incredible Rural Health Transformation Grant Program. It is part of, I believe, the big beautiful bill, and it really is an opportunity for our rurals to finally get attention that is much deserved and much needed. So, Marcia, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marcia Turner, and I'm very happy to provide this overview for you. Can we bring my slides up, please? Okay. So this is probably the first time I'm ever going to focus on the cover slide, because I found this awesome county image of the state of Nevada. And it's just a reminder, and especially from an NCHE standpoint, the 13 regents cover the whole state. And all the institutions cover the whole state. And I know Amber Denali, hope I get this right, that GBC covers like 86,000 square miles, some crazy amount of space. Every time I say that, I think I need to double check it, because it's such a big number. But it's a great reminder of how big Nevada is and what an important resource the system of higher education, with all of our institutions and all of their special missions and all of their special territories and remote campuses and everything that we have throughout Nevada, we are in a really good position to be an important resource for this grant. So a little bit of the background. Yes, it was part of the Big Beautiful Bill, and in my view, one of the most beautiful things in the bill. It started out as a $25 billion allocation to help improve rural health, to help bridge the gap in services, the fact that many rural communities don't have providers, they don't have hospitals, they don't have clinics, and there's a large distance to get to any care. And this is true throughout the country. And so it started out as $25 billion, and then I think it was Alaska, they really put some heat on the feds, and it ended up doubling. So it was $50 billion. And there's two tranches of money. The first tranche of money, every state is eligible to receive $100 million a year for 5 years as a baseline. The second tranche of money is competitive. And so what the federal government did was, when they created this process, they started, they did a grant application process. So every state was asked to submit a $200 million one-year grant, so that it was apples to apples in evaluating the proposals, because the second half is competitive. And so the state of Nevada, the Nevada Health Authority, is the entity that owns this grant, and they have done a terrific job of convening people and bringing all voices to the table and doing a lot of work with the rural communities to make sure that we're not jumping to solutions, that we're really identifying the rural need and working backwards from that. And they've asked for feedback. One of the public meetings they had 400 people on the call. They had to ask people to turn off their cameras so that the system didn't crash. So it is a very popular, high-profile thing, and I would imagine all states are having that situation. So it's something that is going to be very competitive to go after these funds. It's really an exciting thing, because that means that healthcare professionals throughout the state are really getting creative and trying to identify ways that they could help solve the problem of gaps in healthcare services for the rurals. So at the end, like the last quarter of last year, there was a lot of public feedback to help the Nevada Health Authority developed that $200 million grant proposal. As you can imagine, NCHE and all of our institutions played a really important role in that, and we really just had professors and clinicians from all over the system submit really great ideas, and the Health Authority incorporated a lot of our ideas. So they submitted their proposal in early November, at the end of December, Nevada, all the states got their notification of how much the award was, and Nevada was awarded just shy of $180 million for 1 year. And there's four more years to come. So before that happened, before the holidays, Chancellor McNair has been, you know, we've been working, tracking this, you know, all the schools have, we have it and at the NSHE level. And we knew that this was going to be a fast and furious process because once you get the money, you have to deploy it. It's going to be really complicated. And there's a lot of competition and interest in this. And so we wanted to make sure that throughout the system, we were all talking to one another. So Chancellor McNair sent out a request to all the presidents to appoint one person to represent their school on an NSHE coordinating council for this rural grant, and I'm facilitating that council. I've met with each of the members. I'm going to go through my slides. So, big, beautiful bill. So let me go back to the so the Nevada Health Authority. There's in the materials. There's good links to any background materials, and I'm happy to brief anybody offline too. So when Nevada got their money, these are the four different buckets that the money's going to go into. So and they have different percentages, but they're the priorities for Nevada's funding. Is going into these four buckets. So the first bucket is really looking at chronic disease prevention and management and how do we actually bring care out to the rurals. The Flex Fund is looking at the rural infrastructure. Do we need to have buy mobile vans? Do we need to get more equipment, MRIs out into the rural? So it's kind of more of a infrastructure. This grant does not allow new construction, but it can allow renovation of facilities to bring them up to speed. And that is actually an opportunity for us to look at any of our existing infrastructure throughout Nevada to look at if we can do some renovations to help be able to like set up a clinic or renovate dorms so that we can accommodate more folks. The workforce development, and so that sort of help grow our own, but it's also looking at how do we attract new grads to move out to the rurals to set up their practice. That is by far the largest amount of funds, and we're going to be working really carefully on that because I think from as a healthcare and workforce development entity, that's really kind of our sweet spot. But our clinicians are also really important in this. And then the last bucket is the use of technology. How do we help do new innovative ways of providing care through telemedicine, remote patient monitoring, the use of technology, and innovative ways of delivering care to bridge that gap. So it's really kind of a nice bundle of things. And so the state is working right now on developing RFPs for each of these different buckets. They're hiring staff, because as you can imagine, deploying $180 million is a complicated thing. And so, and then while they're doing that, they're also trying to make sure we're ready for the next year too. And so the Nevada Health Authority has done a great job of managing this, and they're just humming. They're hiring staff and they're developing the RFPs, and they're gonna be coming soon. But we're not waiting for that. So all of the schools are working because we've got enough information to kind of anticipate what the different RFP buckets are gonna be and where we have opportunities to like start getting our proposals ready. And so back to the committee we have formed. So the chancellor created this coordinating committee because we don't want all our schools like doing their own thing and not talking to one another, because we could inadvertently have competing proposals or proposals that if we bundle them together, we could be a stronger delivery of whatever the service is. And then also just making sure that we're optimizing our contribution to this and that we're also being really careful to make sure that anything we're doing, we're starting with what is the rural need. We're not just throwing a solution at them. We're trying to help be part of the solution to whatever they've already defined to be the need. And so we have this coordinating council. So these are the four areas. I've kind of already gone through the buckets. There's more information. They will be March is the soonest that the first RFPs are going to come out. So it's really this, between now and summer, it's going to be really busy. But all the schools are doing their own thing individually to try and wrangle, like, what, make sure everyone knows about it, encourage people to start thinking about it, encourage them to cross-pollinate within their schools, nurses, doctors. And then we're also trying to help make sure that they're reaching across the aisle to different schools. And so there's a lot of work going on within all the schools right now. So then we have, this is our coordinating council that Each of the presidents have recommended, appointed these folks to sit on the council. And it is a great group of people. And it has been so fun talking to each one of them, you know, giving them the background, identifying where they come from, what they're looking at, how they're, you know, what they're excited about, their ideas of how they can reach out across the aisle. So I've met with everybody individually at least once. We had the kickoff meeting, and Chancellor McNair helped us do the kickoff. And then our next meeting is tomorrow. And then we just have the goal of basically making sure that we're competitive, you know, not against each other, but that we can bring together the most competitive proposals that are really helping to move the needle as far as what we can do to help improve care in Nevada. We do, in addition to the council members, Natalie Brown is going to be helping with the workforce development piece because that's such a big piece and she's so great in that area. We have John Packham from UNR School of Medicine and Sarah Hunt, who works at UNLV School of Medicine. John is very involved in rural health and workforce development, and Sarah does a Be Here Nevada, which is a statewide mental health program. And then, of course, Marcy Jackson from our EPSCoR office are sort of my SMEs that I will be having help with pulling things together. Another thing is that the Nevada Health Authority has developed a steering committee, a statewide steering committee, and we were fortunate enough to have three different NSHE representatives on that committee. I'm going to be representing NSHE. Amber Denali will be representing GBC, and then Gerald Ackerman, who works with John Packham, is going to be representing the State Office of Rural Health, which actually is housed within UNR. And Gerald runs the Project Echo program, so he's been doing rural health for years. And so it's really a neat opportunity. In addition to the three NSHE members, there's like the Rural Hospital Association, and it's a really great committee. And that steering committee is going to be helping provide guidance to the health authority for this year and as we work through the future years. So I think it's a neat honor. I'm honored to participate and to represent NSHE. And I think it's really a neat opportunity for all of us. And I'm really glad that President Denali is also on there because she has such a unique perspective on things and brings such great experience. And then same with Gerald. So that's the high-level overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Marcia. That's a wonderful, wonderful overview. $180 million is a lot of money. It's very exciting. I have a quick question. Like when you're talking about the technology and innovation, is this like an opportunity for a UNLV or a UNR to kind of think outside of the box and do something? Or is this really just, I see that they're all on that committee, so they must be able to ask for some money. And I'm just wondering what that entails.
That's a great question. Thank you. For the record, Marcia Turner. So what we've kind of struggled with a little bit is if the RFPs are in each of the individual buckets, so you've got the technology bucket RFP, you've got the workforce development bucket RFP, what if we are submitting a proposal for remote monitoring of moms and we're going to have residents and also technology? So that's one of the things that we've got to figure out, how we submit and optimize our grant opportunities, but also develop programs. So whether it's teleconsults for mental health, or so the use of telemedicine, the use of remote patient monitoring, there's all kinds of opportunities. It also brings in our other departments, because a lot of times you just think of medicine and nursing, but you know, the physiology, like folks who are doing MRIs, or it could also be our IP research department. Like we might be working with a remote patient monitoring company or something where we can have some IP in there too. And one other thing, even though the focus is really on care and the delivery of care and the innovation of the delivery of care, one of the things we want to do on top of whatever grants we're going to do is research. Because every grant has an evaluation. Did you do what you said you were going to do? And that's going to be really important to make sure we get the subsequent money from a federal standpoint, and we help support the state's ability to say, yes, we spent the money, and we'd pass an audit. But the other thing, too, is what did we learn from outcomes? Like, because we were able to do remote patient monitoring of moms, did they have less emergencies and have to, you know, be air vac to renown?
is there some way where, like, okay, we're going to be doing remote patient monitoring or telemedicine, but the IT system's not working. So we've got Ann and her folks in the loop too. So we're looking, so there's a lot of opportunities for everybody to come to the table, and that's what we're trying to make sure we're not leaving anybody out.
It's a lot of money. Go for it. Regent Boylan, you had something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, ma'am, for the great presentation knowledge. Actually, I have lots of things I didn't know came up. And thanks for giving the board this presentation. Where do you see the board fitting in this? Why are we getting this information? How can we help? What can we do?
Thank you, Regent Boylan. For the record, Marcia Turner. I am so glad you asked that, because one of the things I thought of when I showed that map was regents have rural areas, and even in the urban areas, we've got, you know, Mesquite. And so we, I think that we just wanted to make sure everybody knew about it, because this is an important thing. We wanted to make sure that you knew how hard the schools are working and how much the president's chancellor on down recognize that this is an important thing. This is a neat opportunity, and we need to lean in on it. And so we want to just make sure that you knew that your schools are doing a really good job on this. And then as it moves forward, if anybody has any interest, if you have any ideas, if you have partners, because that's one of the other things, we want to make sure we're partnering with the rural areas. And so especially any of the regents who have rural territories, if you have, like, I know so-and-so on the PTA, or I've worked with the Rural Hospital Association, we're doing a pretty good job of working with the outside partners. But any ideas that you have, we welcome them. And I'm happy to be a conduit or talk to anybody. Things are moving so fast, we don't want to get in the way of any of it. But any good ideas are welcome.
One more question. When there's so much money involved, and I know I love the big, beautiful bill and all the good things in there. Does the committee does her committee keep an eye on what's happening? Who do you answer to with all this money? And is there a representative, I'm trying to say, who will audit you or keep an eye on what you're doing? I mean, it's awesome. I love it. All these things and all the people who are, they're all volunteers, right? Like President Donnelly, she's volunteering out there, right? That's awesome. I love the fact she's doing it. How do we keep an eye on what you're doing? Do you give us regular reports to this committee, to the chair, to the board? But there's, you know, and there's so much money, I'm like, you know, I need to find out if it's spent correctly, is what I'm getting at.
Right.
It's not that I don't trust anyone. I just don't trust anyone. So I try to keep an eye on such things, and I'm like, whoa, it's opening the door. You know that locks are meant for keeping good people honest. They're not for thieves, because I can get into any lock. I'm not a thief, but there's a lot of people who can. They're just for honest people.
Right.
So how do we, Madam Chair, maybe I should pass this on to you. What do we do, this board? How do we do this?
The money is federally allocated.
Yeah.
We will be audited by the federal government.
Awesome.
The state is allocating the dollars.
Yeah. No, I get all that.
From the federal government. So there's multiple. There's no. I know where you're going with this, and,
yeah.
And she will not be a part of any kind of fraud. So we'll just...
Oh, no, never.
We're all very up and up, and we're going to keep it straight. So
no,
I appreciate the question, but
yeah.
There's a lot of auditing procedures
I totally... Let me just finish with this. And I totally understand. Everybody looks so honest. I love it. Not that I trust you, but you look awesome. All these audits and things, eventually we will be blamed, the board, as always. Because the buck stops here. When the things go wrong, chancellors, one or two who have gone, and others, then they say, well, that's policy of the board. Well, the board was responsible for it. How are we going to be responsible for it?
If I may, for the record, Marcia Turner. So
yes,
we have our coordinating council, and we carefully named it a coordinating council because we are not deciding which grants get submitted. So it's a normal, formal, very formal, federal, through the state, grant
proposal. Well, I get all that,
proposal.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
And so, and the other thing, just to make sure, I hope we get all $180 million, but it's probably not going to be all that, but it will be very specific, a grant proposal, a competitive process, an award of a grant with all the terms and all the audit stuff that just happened, all that will apply to every single one. And I would imagine, because this is such a high-profile thing, there'll be a lot of eyes on it. And I think the neat thing is that our programs, I think, are ready to step up and then be able to, with all the review and evaluation, make sure that we are on it all the way through.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Marcia. Thank you, Regent. Anyone else? Regent Brager.
She was going to forget me. No. Just a quick question in regards to when you talk about partnerships. And I know we have, even though we are state, we have Nye County, Clark County, things like that. So as an example, I'd like to ask, like Southern Hills Hospital is 50 minutes from Pahrump. And would we create partnerships with something like that where our underserved in Sandy Valley, Good Springs, Mountain Springs, and Level Canyon, I was fortunate enough to have those for 24 years. So those areas that are underserved and with our system, is that something we would look at? And you don't have to belabor it, but I mean, it seemed like a great opportunity to bring in a hospital that loves, and I'm vice chair of their hospital, so it's easy to speak about some of the things that we do.
Yeah, thank you for that question. For the record, Marcia Turner, yes. And we're doing that all over. It's almost like just a resource map. Like,
okay.
It, like for Elko, it might be Utah is closer. You know, you never know where, and really time matters, and bridging the distance is what this is all about. So, yes.
Thank you. That would be so exciting to be able to bridge that even better and know that people have services closer to where they are than having to go, you know, from the Pahrump is really closer to us, but it's served by the north, which is fine, but yeah. It'd be fun when we change some of that.
Thank you, Regent Brager. Regent McGrath?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. Your enthusiasm, I mean, obviously this is incredibly important work, and I'm so happy that the federal government has realized the importance of it, so it's wonderful. And your enthusiasm is absolutely infectious. It's joyful. So thank you for your hard work on this. This isn't, I think a question would be premature. I just want to make a comment. It would be nice to, even though this is such a tremendous windfall and hopefully it ends up being the $880 million, I think it would be nice to always keep an eye on sustainability.
Oh, thank you.
I'd be interested to hear, you know, whether there are maybe public-private partnerships that can begin so these programs don't just expire, even though, of course, you know, we're not quite looking to the future that far, but maybe we should.
And excuse me, for the record, Marcia Turner, thank you for that question. That's something I've neglected to mention. Sustainability is a requirement for the grants. So as we're putting forth proposals, every grant has to have a sustainability plan, which gets tricky if you're asking for 1 year money and you know it's going to go further. But that's another reason why the outside partners are good. That's why the research to show like the financial sustainability, if we save money because we did telemedicine, how do we make an argument that it could be funded by Medicaid, those kind of things. So yes, that was embedded in the federal requirements.
Thank you, Regent McGrath. Regent Del Carlo?
Sorry, it's hard to get the unmute on. Thank you so much, Marcia. And I am one of those two regions that has lots of rural counties, have 7. And I know that healthcare can be a desert out there, literally. And I know that Tonopah is not in my district, but Tonopah lost their hospital a few years back. And their closest medical facility is in Hawthorne now, which is a pretty good ride. But so is this going to be able to, like, put more medical facilities in a place like Tonopah? I can't imagine being in a town that has no medical facilities.
Thank you for that question. For the record, Marcia Turner. So in general, and we won't be providing every single service, but and they did specifically say you can't do new construction. So there won't be any new facilities built, but there will be things like one of the suggestions is we, with the dental school and the two dental hygiene programs at TMC and CSN, that's one example of the dental school has a mobile van. So how do we figure right. out how to take the show on the road and go out to the different, you know, like have a tour, and then maybe we have a GBC facility somewhere that they have an extra classroom. Let's put some dental chairs in it. Let's, you know, renovate their HVC or whatever we need to do. So I think that there are certain things that we can do to bring professionals out to work in a clinic that already exists to give them extra capacity, or get creative in figuring out how to set up a new clinic. And then I would imagine the rural hospitals are also going to be looking at, so we're not alone in this, but that's part of the partnership thing. But it's yeah. all about getting more access directly there, or figuring out how to do it telemedicine, or also transporting people into the rural, into the urban areas as needed.
And I just want to publicly thank you for absolutely your enthusiasm on this. And thank the chancellor. I wasn't aware that we had gotten this grant and this money. I mean, that's a huge amount. It really is. And I'm so glad to see some attention on the rural areas, because they really do end up coming in second many, many times. So thank you, chancellor, for putting this robust task force together. And I'm looking forward to hearing more from you down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. Go ahead.
And thank you, Marcia Turner, for the record. I just wanted to say thank you to the governor and to Stacey Weeks and Jason Bleek and Melinda Southard and the whole team at the Nevada Health Authority. They have been terrific to work with, and they are doing such a great job. And this is a really big job, but they're great partners on this and many other things, and I just wanted to thank them.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a great presentation. I just wish I would have worn my... Carol, I believe you have one of these, the necklace with all of my Nevada counties in turquoise. But
oh, yeah.
Anyway, okay. All right, moving forward, we'll move forward to item number 5. We have the UNLV Kirkorian School of Medicine Accreditation and University Medical Center Affiliation Study. We're going to have... our interim dean, Dr. Allison Netsky. She's going to provide us with an overview of academic, administrative, and clinical operations. She's going to include an update on the accreditation status, UNLV health performance, and the UMC affiliation negotiations. So a lot, not much at all, Dean Netsky. So go ahead and please start it.
Chair Goodman, I just want to say thank you for allowing us the opportunity to have a discussion about the Kirkorian School of Medicine at UNLV, and I want to thank Dean Netsky for stepping into the leadership role during this interim period. As you note, there's so much going on at the School of Medicine, and it's terrific to have the opportunity to talk about the good work and make sure that the regents are fully informed and any questions that you may have are answered. Thank you.
Thank you. And it was I did speak with Dean Netsky, and I asked her to keep the presentation, just so everyone knows, just kind of at a minimum so that we could have that robust discussion and not go over time. So thank you so much, Dean Netsky. It's all yours.
Great. Thank you very much, everyone. Happy to be here today. I've been in the interim role as the dean at the Kirkorian School of Medicine now for about 10 months. So this is a great opportunity to be able to share some updates about great things that we're doing, and just really talk about a number of projects and really where we are after we've been here for next year. It will be 10 years since we've had our first medical school class, and it also has been 10 years since UNLV Health was incorporated as a 501c3. So this is a nice opportunity to talk about where we've been, some things we're doing now, and what our opportunities are in the future. This just highlights really what our School of Medicine team looks like right now after, you know, we've been here, since 2017. We're a really robust group that includes our medical students, our couple and family therapy students, our GME programs, and also our UNLV Health Enterprise. We create, at a very basic level, a pipeline to be able to grow the workforce, healthcare workforce here in Nevada, and be able to care for our community. And so everything we do falls into these various pillars, and sometimes we get pulled into conversations about doing other things, and we really try to stay pure to our mission and tell people we need lots of partners in order to fulfill our mission to grow, you know, grow the healthcare and make this a great place for new recruitment of businesses so that we have really great healthcare here. So I'll share some updates about great things that are happening. We continue to have a really robust recruitment. We're recruiting our 10th class of medical students. We had a record number of total applications, and out of this number, we have about 400 applicants that have great ties to Nevada that meet the minimum requirements that we look for the School of Medicine. And so that is something that is really, really fantastic, that we have a great pool of individuals that are going to be in our pipeline. We measure ourselves against some national standards. One is the what's called the USMLE, which is the United States Medical Licensing Exam, which all medical students have to take. They take the first two in medical school and the third one in their residencies. And so having fantastic numbers like this really shows that we are delivering compared to other medical schools in the country. March 20th, in a couple of weeks from now, will be our match day for our School of Medicine, so we'll know where all of our current medical students are going to be doing their residency programs, and we will also find out who is going to be joining us into our 11 residencies and our 13 fellowship programs. In our previous years, we've had some really great results with 100% residency match rate, so our students all have a job in a residency program when they leave here, and we've had some good results with matching you know, a little less than half into primary care and roughly 41% into programs into Nevada. So one of our other jobs is to grow the pipeline. So not just from medical school through residency, but we need to be partners with all of the institutions, Nevada State University, UNLV, UNR, and also our high schools and other groups to get people excited and get them prepared to come to medical school. And so we do a lot of partnerships, mentoring programs. And this past summer, we did a great program with an early anatomy engagement program for 4 weeks with undergraduate students that are interested in medical school. And it was our first time, great results, and a great mentoring opportunity. No discussion is going to be complete without talking about our accreditation. We had our full accreditation site visit last October, and we were notified on the 13th of February that we will continue with full accreditation. The LCME has 30 days after they notify us to give us our full letter, and so we're still waiting for receipt of that. But the most important thing in that email that said, we voted and you have full accreditation. So I just want to give a thanks to our entire team. Accreditation of the MD program is really important. We take it really seriously, and our team did a really fantastic job. And so I just want to share that gratitude with them. Next, I'm going to just spend a little bit of time talking about our graduate medical education programs and some new things that we're doing related to GME. This is really the second part of the life cycle of you know, growing our workforce, is getting our medical students not only from our medical school, but having opportunities for all of the other students that are in medical school to you know, to enter into our programs. We currently have 11 residency and 13 fellowship programs, and we're hopefully going to be able to take advantage of the GME expansion grant program that the Nevada Health Authority has launched. The application is open right now, and we're likely going to be applying for at least one new program and possibly some expansions in some of our smaller programs. Funding for GME programs is a complex enterprise, and this graph here shows really who our partners are and where some of our funding comes from. Residents and fellows are employees. They get a paycheck, they get health insurance benefits, and so the starting a new program has to have some sustainability. The premise that funds GME is a CMS program that started in the late 90s. And basically what hospitals have to do is they have 5 years from the first resident that starts in order to build up to what their maximum potential is for reimbursement from the federal government. There's been a lot of work that's been done to try to change this program, but nothing is really on the horizon yet. And so virtually every hospital in Nevada is capped. And so new programs either are paid for based on the hospital margin, through philanthropy, or potentially in the future through some new partnerships with Medicaid that we've been talking with the Nevada Health Authority related to. Clearly, UMC is our largest partner. We also have a very strong partnership with the VA, some state rural partners, and a really great partnership with the United States Air Force. Based on the complexity of these programs, making sure that we're meeting the accreditation requirements and giving everyone the best experience that we can, there sometimes can be some challenges or overlaps. And I'll share an example of this. You know, we have residents that work at different hospitals. One example is Sunrise and UMC. And so we provide information to these hospitals about where our residents have been, how much they've worked, and then they claim the federal government to be able to draw down those funds. So the federal government does their due diligence, and they do a reconciliation process. And if they find that two hospitals have claimed the same residents, then they notify them, the hospitals, and say, you guys need to figure this out, and you have this many days or months to be able to get back to us. And so we were involved with UMC and Sunrise with a notification last year in which Sunrise had claimed 21 of our residents that we did not have an agreement with, and they had not been paying us salaries. And so we worked collaboratively with them to, you know, get that resolved so that UMC could rightfully claim 21 of those residents. The last one that was on the sheet was a scheduling issue between obstetrics and pediatrics, where we both do have arrangements. And so it's really an example of the checks and balances that occur to ensure that, you know, the hospitals are claiming residents for which they are paying their salaries. And we have a good process for being able to work with the reconciliation. But situations like this do help us look at opportunities to do better and figure out how we can get better. And so over this past year, since July, we have increased the rigor of our internal process for internal checks and balances to make sure that the invoices that we're sending out are as accurate as possible. And we're right now looking at a new program that is some other institutions are using that uses the kind of the timekeeping app, and it uses some kind of geofencing capabilities where we put in all of the locations where residents would be working, which includes our clinics, where they would be doing kind of didactics, the VA, you know, the state psychiatric hospital, et cetera. And so it automatically tracks, you know, when they were there, when they're going to be leaving. And so it provides a nice third-party verification. So we are looking at what our options are for adding it onto our current vendor or using a new vendor. Optimistically, we would have this rolled out by July, but I don't have the exact technical details right now. But that's one of the, you know, one of the projects, you know, that we're looking at right now.
Thank you.
I'm happy to take questions throughout if it's easier, or I'm happy to keep going as well.
Yeah, no, and quickly, thank you for addressing that, and I love this technology, and, you know, that way there aren't any questions mm-hmm. as to who's where. How does that affect the exclusive affiliation that we have had with UMC? So what is the process if our residents are supposed to solely be at UMC? What is the process for them to go to another hospital?
So we have a pretty transparent process with all of our partners, and we have a master, we'll just call it an FTE spreadsheet, where it shows I'll just use psychiatry as an example because I kind of know that one a little readily off my top of my head, where we will say residents in each of these years are spending, you know, this much time doing this kind of work at UMC. And this is the amount of work on which months and which people are doing stuff at Ross and Neal Psychiatric Hospital and the VA and others. And so we have a kind of predetermined master list. So, but sometimes things have to change, and it might be because service line changes. Perhaps the volume at UMC can't be met, or maybe there's a new residency requirement, and that service isn't readily available with one of our current partners. When that occurs, we go to UMC and we tell them, look, we need a new experience in let's just say it was geriatric psychiatry. And are you able to fulfill this? If you're not able to fulfill it, you know, we're going to be looking at going for to other partners. And so we have a right of first refusal mechanism in place. It has been used. And then there's some instances where maybe it hasn't been used in the past. And so that's something that in our current agreement, we're really making sure that the language, especially as it pertains to GME, is not open to interpretation, because that is, quite honestly, one of the challenges in our previous affiliation agreement is the definitions of some things could be interpreted one way or another way. And so that's something we both parties do not want to have happen again. So we're using lots of resources and kind of stress testing what some opportunities would look like and figuring out if everyone would land in the same place.
Thank you. I think that sounds like a wonderful solution. And I know you weren't the dean yet then, but thank you for acknowledging that it hasn't always been that way. So I really appreciate that candor.
Thanks.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions at this point? Regent Brager?
And if I missed the slide, I apologize. I was paying attention. How many of our students are accepted in our system from our state? And I know we want the best and the brightest, and I believe we have them here. And then I want to, before you answer that, I know the West Career Technical Academy.
Let me get off my call.
Does someone visit there because they have a medical component to it? To see, I've always thought, wouldn't it be exciting if when they were in, just like we do dual credit, and maybe you're doing some of it at 11th and 12th grade, those that absolutely know they want to be a doctor, a dentist, something in the medical field, could start their careers earlier than later, which would help some of the costs and get them into the system much sooner, is just a thought.
So let me just clarify the first question. Are you talking about how many of our students have ties to Nevada or are Nevada kids?
And have been accepted, yes.
Yep. So that is our most important criteria, is kids who have ties to Nevada. So whether they went to high school here and are in one of the NC institutions, many have gone to high school here, gone out of state for college, and are coming back. And then a number of them have grandparents, parents that have moved here, or other kinds of things. We take the responsibility of, you know, doing everything that we can to retain them in Nevada. I mean, that is without a doubt our most important. Well, obviously they have to meet the marks, but our most important criteria. As it pertains to, you know, working with the high schools, we work with lots of high schools. I will tell you, I can't tell you for sure each one, but we can certainly get you a list of all of our partners. There is a program that is present at some schools. It's called the BSMD program, and so it shortens 2 years off of the program, and a lot of programs have closed in really the last 5 to 7 years, and a lot of it has to do with kind of the students not being ready to manage the rigor and the maturity and the content when they get to medical school, and seeing a higher drop-off rate for those students being able to get through medical school. We've thrown around the idea of that, you know, of that kind of program, but really haven't put any kinds of planning in place to, you know, at this time.
Thank you. And we want to make sure they're ready. I just know that mm-hmm. the Career Technical Academy yep. up west, is a very strong component mm-hmm. of students that actually do medical.
Yep.
And that's why I asked. And in the future, if we could maybe have a conversation on how it's working and what you can do, because I just think it's very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much
Thanks.
For your answer.
Thanks.
Go ahead and continue. Thank you.
So we have a great retention rate. About, you know, two-thirds of our residents are staying in Nevada to practice, which is really fantastic. And there's a lot of specialties that you can really see an improvement in access over the, over the past number of years. So what's next? We're going to be putting an application together for an ophthalmology program. We have a great partnership. So this will be kind of a private nonprofit med school philanthropy partnership to launch this program. Ophthalmology is on the list of programs where we are really, really behind the national average. Right now we have about 120 ophthalmologists that are practicing in our community, and we need about 66 more full-time working today to just meet the national average. And one of the other workforce pieces of data, when we're looking at, you know, where we should be looking, is what percentage of the workforce is over age 55. And so for ophthalmology right now, it's over 65% of that workforce. And so, really looking at where we're going to hit that, that cliff where you're going to see a big decrease. So that's, a program where I think we're going to have a lot of success. Our application will go in over the summer. And then we're going to be looking at if we have opportunities for more GME programs. We do have a rural health family medicine residency program in partnership with Humboldt General Hospital in Winnemucca. And we're looking with the rural health programs if we might have some other opportunities. I just wanted to do a quick highlight. We
in
have
Metzke, she
oh,
had
yes.
a quick
oh, sure.
our region breaker is very involved. Go
you,
ahead, region.
You mentioned I love serving on a hospital board. It makes me dangerous. Mm-hmm. Anesthesiology. I know that sometimes a surgical procedure cannot happen at the time they
yep.
like because we're so short. Is that something we're looking at? I
don't
want to prolong this.
So we currently are not looking at anesthesia, and shockingly, when you look at the Nevada workforce statistics, anesthesia is the only program that is listed as being sufficient. Now, I will tell you, I believe it's because there are a lot of people that are anesthesiologists that are doing pain management and that are not doing surgery. And, so figuring out how we can get around those numbers so that specialty can become grant eligible is something that we have to do some work on. Anesthesia is something that is on the list with UMC of, potential new programs, and so we would really, look forward to being a partner with them. At our current point on our own, we would not be able to do anesthesia because we do not have any anesthesiologists on our faculty.
Thank you so much, but you hit it completely right. It is the pain management that's taking away that viable work, but I factually know, not just where I serve, mm-hmm. but across the board that surgeries are postponed due
yep.
to not being able to have the anesthesia.
Yes,
so
more about this because this is a huge pain point
thank
for
you
us
for
as
follow
well.
Up in hopefully within the next year Absolutely. Or so that we can yep. really look into that. Thank you for that answer.
And if I could comment briefly, Regent Brager, you may recall that not long ago the board approved us to have a certified registered nurse anesthesia program. So we'll start producing graduates who'll be able to serve in the role of anesthesiologist under MD supervision.
I do also want to do a shout out that we do have the School of Dental Medicine has a partnership with UMC for a dental anesthesia residency program. And I did receive feedback at the Medical Executive Committee meeting with UMC last week about how well it's working. And it's really been a fantastic program.
Thank you both for that. I appreciate it.
Yep. We have a first-class simulation and anatomy program facility at the Medical Education Building, and we have simulated OR, simulated robotic surgery mechanisms, and it makes us first-class when for our GME programs, especially with our surgical subspecialties. So this is just part of our crew here, and it sometimes is overlooked. It is, nationwide, a really first-class facility. I'm just going to do a quick highlight. We're moving the mark in research. Every year, we're seeing increases in the number of external grants that we're getting to help fund our research enterprise. You know, we have a long way to go, but we're investing in infrastructure, statisticians, grant writers, and others, so that we can support our faculty as much as we can. We're also showing an increase in our number of proposals that we're submitting. And the gross number of grants that we're receiving. The little FY22 increase there is related to the ARPA grants, you know, during COVID, where UNLV did have a really large number of grants. Just a brief review of some of the things that we're doing. We are first in class with our Alzheimer's research program in our Department of Brain Health. And we also have a really significant footprint in traffic safety and injury prevention research in our, in our Department of Surgery. Everything we do, we try to tie back to our community. Some of it is really direct with patient care, but then some of it is separate with some of our programs, like our Walk with a Doc program, where we try to get our patients more engaged in their healthcare and creating events for them to be able to come out and, you know, talk to their physicians and, you know, feel more comfortable with asking questions. So we have an activity once a month. And then we're also doing things at a number of our community centers as it relates to, working with kids. We also do things with a number of our rural partners to try to increase the opportunities to prevent very bad things. And so, as an example, we have an advanced life support and obstetrics program in which the faculty from our family medicine program that are certified in this work and train EMTs, nurses, OBGYNs, and family physicians on, you know, managing obstetrical emergencies, just as an example of some of the activities that we're doing. We also have a model military medicine program, and so I sometimes it just doesn't get enough press. We have a military civilian partnership that is with the Air Force, the School of Medicine, and UMC, and I think if these three groups can get together and make something work well, then we can do anything, because they both have pretty significant bureaucracies behind them. But we have 37 active duty Air Force physicians that work hand in hand, indistinguishable from our paid faculty. We have 41 embedded residents that are active duty in a number of our programs. And we also have programs where we have military physicians that are rotating through in order to stay deployment ready. This has really become the model nationwide, and our trauma director, Deb Cools, and our Office of Military Medicine director, Jeremy Kilburn, who is a pulmonary critical care physician, have done a really nice job modeling this, and they get asked to go to conferences nationwide. And so it's really something definitely that our community should be proud of. We've seen some increases in our charitable giving. Where does this money go? It really goes to support some of our research enterprise, some of our residency and fellowship programs are partially supported through philanthropy, and some of our clinical care at our school-based health clinics. We have two school-based health clinics in partnership with Clark County School District, and our partnership with them, our partnership agreement says that we will not have payment be a barrier to care. And in those clinics, we see about 70% of the kids have no insurance. And so those are some of the areas. In addition, we're really trying to recruit new scholarship donors this year in order to help reduce that delta between federal unsubsidized loans and the elimination of Grad PLUS loans, which a great many professional students use. And so we're actively on a campaign for more scholarships right now so that the cost of medical school does not become a barrier for any of our local kids. So I want to spend a little bit of time just sharing with you kind of you know, where we've been, where we're at right now. The competition for hiring physicians nationwide is tough. I mean, everywhere you go, there's not enough healthcare, there's not enough physicians. And in the area of academic medicine, it really narrows because it's a bit of a different lifestyle. The salaries are not as high as if you were in private practice. And there's a lot of work that happens outside of work with research, mentorship, scholarship, teaching, preparing for teaching. And so that, you know, really narrows our field. So there's a lot of competition for the folks that that we're trying to get to come here. So over the last year, we've engaged in some new tools. So we've subscribed and purchased some databases that show the names, the contact information, the specialties, and a number of years since people graduated. And so we can do some more targeted recruiting in addition to our regular recruiting that we do with advertising, going to specialty conferences. And we've seen a real uptick in the number of people that are interested in coming to Vegas. And we do an enormous amount of work trying to convince people we don't live on the Strip and that we all raise our kids here. And there's because, you know, the image of Vegas, if people haven't been here, is one of entertainment and not necessarily, you know, one of community. And so we've done a lot of work related to that. We also have really been paying a lot of attention to some of the workforce questionnaires that are being done nationally on what people are looking for as far as what are the priorities that you're looking for when you're looking for a job for people who are graduating residency. And without a doubt, work-life balance is number one now. You know, 5 or 10 years ago, it would have been salary. Now it's work-life balance. And so we do a number of things that we think really helps meet that mark. Our clinics are closed on all the major holidays. You know, financially, that is, you know, a little bit of a gamble for us, but the number of people that work for us that have school-age kids is really significant. And so that is a benefit. And you know, in addition to obviously having paid time off, which if you're in private practice or other places, that doesn't necessarily happen. This year in FY26, we are trending better than we were last year. I think at the end of the fiscal year, we probably will have hired about 27 new faculty. And we also have really seen an uptick in part-time faculty. And so those are kind of reflected in a different area. And that's why I kind of put an asterisk, you know, on here. But we have a number of people who are working for us that are part-time and are 100% happy with it because they have family needs. They don't want to, you know, have a full FTE job. And those people see patients in our clinics along with our students and residents. A number of them are part-time faculty in the MD program and in other areas as well. So we also have instituted this year a process for a retention program. We have a new medical school in town, and so there's competition for our really good faculty. And so we've had a number of our faculty that have been directly recruited by the competition locally. We've lost a couple, but a number of them are coming to us and saying, we really love it here and we really want to stay, but this place down the road who's a private medical school is offering a higher salary. And so we have a process in place now where we have about a 72-hour turnaround to be able to make them a retention offer, which is really, really fantastic. And, took a just good partnership and good work in order to do that. So that's another thing that we're doing. And in addition to really highlighting the opportunity for loan forgiveness, the public service loan forgiveness program is still at this time in effect, which really means somebody who, you know, works for us for 10 years will have the entirety of the rest of their student loans forgiven in addition to the Nevada HEALS program and a couple of other programs that sometimes we can qualify for based on some of our locations being underserved and sometimes we can't. And so we're really hitting the recruitment, physician and faculty recruitment from, you know, all of the different angles. But there's there's no doubt that it's tough, and it's really tough when we're trying to recruit the first. We've been on the quest to recruit a pediatric ENT doc for a lot of years, and we've gotten close, but we haven't been able to get somebody, and they're like, yeah, I just don't really want to be the only one and the one that everyone calls, and I'm kind of afraid of what that would do to my my work-life balance. So it's a journey, and you know, we're making some progress, but we still have a lot of we still have a number of vacancies.
Thank you, and I just have a quick question. We've talked about the morale, right? That mm-hmm. when we're just, you know, what is the morale like? And I'd love you to just address why you think that you know, that the morale is not where we'd hope it to be too. I mean, it's like, okay, we're Las Vegas. This is exciting. It's a new medical school. There's so much opportunity here. Yep. I would love to just hear a little.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to share some information about that. So, morale overall is a little bit down coming out of COVID and, you know, in healthcare. This past year has also been a little tougher for healthcare based on some of the, you know, some of the changes and the, you know, some of the burden on physicians working with a higher number of uninsured patients. The reimbursements have gone down, and it just is a little bit of a weird place. We this year we're looking at what is every opportunity that we can do, and so we launched in the fall a survey. It's an employee engagement survey called Standpoint, and it's administered through the Association of American Medical Colleges, so the AAMC, and it's used widely at a lot of medical schools. So this is our first time administering it, and the nice part is we give the information to the AAMC, you know, what the name, the contact information, what is their faculty type, what's their department, and they administer the survey. So there's no risk for us to find out who responded which way, and the AAMC does a really nice job in engaging with the faculty, so they feel really comfortable. Our engagement numbers were higher than what they get on average by a couple of percentage points as far as how many people filled out the survey. And we'll have that information back probably in a couple of weeks, because they curated and put it, you know, a whole presentation for us together. And it's not just about how people are perceiving their, you know, their careers in medicine, but it also evaluates some of the critical drivers of satisfaction. Are you getting mentorship? Are you feeling like you're getting the services that you need in the workplace? And so we're going to be using this data as a really important piece as we later on this spring start kind of the next phase of the strategic plan for the School of Medicine. It's hard to change what you can't measure. And so this is an important, an important piece of information for us, for sure.
And will it just be administration that has access to that data,
nope,
or how does that,
we're gonna,
does that work?
There may be some like maybe department level data that we might just kind of keep more locally, but we're going to share a lot of the information with the entire School of Medicine enterprise to say, hey, this is where we're doing good. This is where, you know, we heard you. We're, you know, kind of not meeting the mark right now, and here's what we're going to be doing about it, and we really want to continue to get your engagement and your, you know, and your feedback. We're all kind of one team, one family, and we need to solve this problem together. It can't just be solved by myself or people in my office. It has to be an enterprise level.
Great.
You know, kind of stuff.
Thank you.
We're also using one of the other drivers of kind of physician dissatisfaction actually is the burden in the clinic with medical records. And, I wish the electronic medical record made things better than paper, but it really hasn't. It actually has created an additional burden on physicians. And so we partner with UMC. We have Epic for our electronic health record, and they have been rolling out some AI tools. And I've had the benefit to experiment at the Epic campus and, kind of be a guinea pig for some of their AI tools as a kind of an obnoxious patient to see, like, how well is this really going to work? And so we have a number of our docs that are that are using this right now, and we expect that it will be widely available in the near future, in addition to some other AI tools that they're using to try to help summarize. You know, let's just say a patient comes in and they have 50 pages of external medical records from another hospital. They're developing tools that will help create a summary for this so the physician can kind of get the high points and then be like, oh, hold on, I need to go and look more into this. But some of the, you know, the information burden and the documentation burden is, it's real. And so that's something else that we're working on. In addition to one other product called Epic Cheers, they usually have, you know, pretty interesting names for all of their things, which will be an opportunity for the for us to set some parameters that will reach out to patients and try to get them in more engaged, and you know, allow them to, you know, contact us through their through the portal for things like colonoscopies and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's a different level of engagement that doesn't require person-to-person contact.
And if I may, and Regent Boylan has a quick question in a moment, but first, if I can, you know, when we talk about like billing for the, you know, for UNLV Health, right? You know, is are we doing the best practices? And I'm thinking that this ECG audit that will come in will help with that. You know, I've heard, you know, centralized billing versus on-site billing. You know, and then when we're talking about scheduling, you know, people send me pictures of empty waiting rooms. I don't know why, but for me, I think it's well, I do know why, because the waiting room's empty. But at the same time, I feel like if ECG can come in there, do you feel like they'll help us with better practice so that we can not leave any money on the table, number one, and then secondly, also make sure that we're seeing as many patients as we can?
Absolutely. I have more information related to our ECG, you know, consultation. And so ECG is a group that really has worked with nearly every academic health group in the United States. So they work with groups that are much larger with us than us, and we've engaged them for you know, a couple of projects, and have a project that will be starting you know, fairly immediately, and will go on for about the next 6 months as it pertains to UNLV Health. And it really has three prongs. One is, you know, we've been here for 10 years and we've done a lot of stuff, but we need to figure out, you know, exactly where we're going. And so do we have the right governance structure, you know, as it pertains to our operating agreement with NSHI, and what is our board, the makeup of our board of directors, and, you know, those kinds of things. So that will be one part of it. The other part will be looking at our a review of our business operations, and part of that is revenue cycle and those kinds of things. You know, should we be investing in, you know, a different general ledger or some different kinds of software, and that kind of stuff. And then the third will be looking at some opportunities in our, you know, clinical operations and also our physician compensation, you know, plan, in addition to helping us do some modeling for things that we probably really need in the future, which is, are things like facilities, so ambulatory surgery center, in order to you know, be able to maximize our revenue for surgical subspecialties and those kinds of things. So those are all you know, scoped out in the terms of the report.
Thank you. Yep. And Regent Boylan, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. Thank you, Dean. Appreciate it. Nice meeting you. I had two quick things. One, like I said to the young lady sitting next to you, how can the board help? I mean, is there anything specific we can do? Should we go on a tour of the country to different medical schools and say, hey, come to us, Chair? I'm just being funny, and my jokes are terrible. But it is a serious thing. What can we do? How can the board help?
I think when we decide on our next direction, we likely are going to need some major infrastructure investment. And part of it is going to be for facilities that we can bill for, like, I'll say, ambulatory surgery center. We aren't going to be able to grow in our current structure as successfully and sustainably as we would like to do. There are some med schools out there that are about 10 years ahead of us. University of Central Florida is one. I was at a psychiatry meeting in Florida recently and had an opportunity to meet with their dean and looked at, where they're at and what kind of investment was necessary to get them there. And so these are just going to be conversations. I don't have necessarily the answers right now, but our current clinical revenue covers a lot of things, but it's not going to be able to cover the cost for build or purchase of something immediately. So what does that look like as far as that kind of investment? So those are going to be some of the conversations that I think this group will be really important in helping us set that direction.
Thank you. And this is one moment to a chair. It's a quick one. Your academic faculty, there were 50, you're down 53 for this year. I'm trying to figure out, when you have 53 less academic faculty, how are you doing the teaching?
So it's not necessarily less. So we have been on a growth strategy. And so a lot of the people in our kind of our bucket of recruitments are people we have never had.
Why?
And so a lot of it is growth, and there are and this is one of the – I was really trying to figure out how to put this data in a really accurate way. We have been able to benefit from a number of part-time faculty. Ideally, we would like them all to be full-time faculty, and so part of that number is filled by part-time, but we're still recruiting for people to ideally fill the full-time, because those people help us fulfill the, all of the pillars, of the mission.
Yeah. Thank you, Dawn. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. I'm going to let you finish your presentation, and then we'll have a few questions.
All right, so I want to spend a little bit more time here talking about finance overview, and this includes both our highlight of our state budget, but then also talking a little bit more in detail about UNLV Health and some of the revenue and the finances and some of our special programs and whatnot. And so this slide is just a snapshot of in an average year where is our money allocated. When we talk about mission areas, obviously there's a lot of bleed over in between these, but in some basic terms, this is how our state money is spent, and this does not include the money that is transferred to the school from UNLV Health. For example, UNLV Health pays UNLV about $27.5 million for faculty salaries for the clinical component of the work that we're doing. This past year, we also had some carryover funds that we are using for investment into our infrastructure, partly related to research and some really important research databases. Part of it is some changes that we need at the MEB and some investments into our anatomy programs, some of our anatomical specimens. These plastinated specimens are over $100,000 each. They apparently are supposed to last forever, and they're really incredible teaching tools for us, and also some new clinical equipment that we can use for teaching for residents and fellows in our clinics. So these are things like, having an EEG, an EMG, and some other kinds of things that allow us to be able to enhance our teaching in the clinical setting. So now that we are at the 10-year mark, we've had a lot of great successes. This is a list of all of the specialties that we have at UNLV Health. And so we are a complex multi-specialty group, meaning that we have so many specialties that range from obstetrics, delivering prenatal care, psychiatry, psychotherapy programs for serious mental illness, complex post-cancer reconstructive surgery, and also primary care. And so the support staff and the infrastructure in order to support all of all of the people in this enterprise is complex and one that we work really hard in order to support our physicians. Just to piggyback on what Regent Brager said about anesthesia, you know, I want to talk a little bit about our, you know, we have a pretty large surgical subspecialty group, and UMC is our primary partner, and we have projects with them, we have a committee, we work really hard to maximize, like, every possible bit of OR space that we can with them, but we have more than, you know, what we can do there, and so we try to work with other ambulatory surgery centers and others. But our challenge is that we have a lot of Medicaid, right? Because we don't turn people away. You know, the public medical school has to be an important partner to the state in serving people who have public insurance. And it mostly boils down to anesthesia. And the reimbursements for anesthesia for Medicaid are about a third of what they would get if they had commercial insurance. And so it is a really serious bottleneck that you know we're you know trying to identify you know solutions for, but right now it is a challenge across Las Vegas, but particularly for you know for groups that you know that serve Medicaid patients.
Would you say the solution is that the state needs to give us higher reimbursement rates for Medicaid?
That certainly
I've heard a lot of people talk about that.
I mean, that certainly would, you know, would open the door for every anesthesiologist group, you know, wanting to accept patients who have this kind of insurance, for sure.
And then I have a quick question with regard to this when we're talking about all of the funding and the state funding. So how do you determine what, you know, when you're talking about some of these individuals that are working and we have the part-time, how do you determine how much of the state dollars goes towards, the, you know, that FTE? You know, how do you figure that out?
So it depends on their role. So if we have you know, a new doctor that's coming and they're in the Department of Internal Medicine and their job is to, you know, round a few weeks a month at UMC with our residents and fellows, and then they have clinic, and then they're expected to, maybe they sit on our admissions committee. So that person would have, you know, about 12% of their salary covered by state funds, and the rest would be covered by revenue from UNLV Health that is then transferred to UNLV to pay their salary. Oftentimes, we have faculty who also are what are considered core faculty, which is a requirement by the ACGME for having X number of core faculty based on the whatever the residency or fellowship is, which basically says we have to protect their time so that they have extra time for teaching, scholarly engagement, committee work as it pertains to the residency program, et cetera. And so more state funding would go towards those. Somebody also may be a clerkship director where they're responsible for the internal medicine clerkship for the medical students. So, you know, the 12-week clerkship that, you know, goes through multiple times per year. And, you know, and so that person would have, you know, potentially 10 to 20% extra, you know, covered because that requires, you know, a lot of non-clinical time. Or if they're a program director, an associate program director, perhaps they have grants. And so, you know, so we have a, you know, formula, mostly formula driven based on these additional kinds of things that people have.
So would you say each employee has a formula that's associated with them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Thank you.
Definitely. So this is a snapshot of FY25, so last year, and the first 6 months of FY26, so July through December of, you know, kind of what are we doing? What's happening at UNLV Health? And so, you know, so we have nine locations. Some of our locations have multiple clinics within one building, but nine physical locations. You know, so last year we did a little more than 166,000 visits, a good number of surgeries, babies delivered, and new patients. So we're trending higher this year than last year, just given the first 6 months. Generally, our second 6 months of the fiscal year is busier. And so we are, you know, we're doing a lot. We're out there seeing a lot of patients. and definitely staying busy.
Quick question: do you have a plan to bring in more patients and like we said before with ECG, you know, retaining more patients, making sure those phone calls come through? I know it's a challenge.
I wish there was a magic solution for phones. We work a lot with Cox on managing the volume of calls and different strategies, and it is surprisingly not as easy as you would think. But so we are looking at other tools as well. So through our electronic health record, we in our part of our internal medicine clinic and also in our pediatrics clinic, we over these last couple of months have started a new project called direct scheduling. And so we try to get every patient what's called a MyChart account, which most people have probably encountered. You go to a hospital or a clinic and they want you to get a login and you can see your record or message your doctor. And so for those two clinics right now, part of internal medicine and pediatrics, we're allowing patients that are already established to be able to direct schedule. And so we're working out the bugs. How's that working? Are people getting what they need? Are patients ending up with the right doctor? And so we're planning on being able to expand that to a number of our other clinics. We're not going to be able to expand it to everyone because a number of our groups, especially on the surgery side, require prior authorization, or we have to ensure that we have the referral before we can schedule the appointment, or the patient shows up and we can't see them or we can't collect for them or those kinds of things. So for those patients, there's a little different avenue that we're looking at, and it's kind of called ticket-directed scheduling, where we've already kind of approved them, and then we send them the link, and then they can find the time that works for them. So it cuts out us having to answer the phone and have a human put their appointment in. So obviously we're not going to get rid of all of our mini call centers and our different clinics because, you know, people have to talk to people in order to get their needs met, but we are looking at other technical solutions in order to, you know, bridge that gap and be more hospitable, you know, practice.
So you know it's there and you're working to fix it. And and maybe ECG can help with that as well, possibly.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. We also have an opportunity to get feedback from our patients. And so we have a couple of years ago, we started a project with this company called Prescani, which is probably the largest company that does patient satisfaction surveys for medical groups. And so every time that you're at a doctor and you get that text message that says like, hey, how was your visit with us? That probably is Prescani. And so they're a very engaging organization because not only do they give you your data, but they also help give you tools on how can you do better. And here's some strategies for doing different kinds of things. And so so every week we get data from the previous week. And so it's really quick. And it looks at what was your experience like with your physician, and what was scheduling like, and what was check-in like, and you know, and people can write comments, and so we, take this report and we narrow it down into, you know, what was the clinic, what was the problem. So it helps us identify hotspots, and then we give these reports to our department chairs so that they can work with their physicians, the faculty physicians, as well. We're trending about 75% positive, like where people are like, yeah, I did pretty good. So that means that we have about 25% that we could definitely do better. Prescani also puts us into cohorts. So, with other academic practices. So when you sign up for them, they say, well, let's figure out who you guys are the most like, what kinds of groups. On the academic practice side, we're definitely on the very small side. You know, most groups have thousands of physicians, and so a lot of the larger groups have more effort and infrastructure into the patient satisfaction, and so their ratings may be always above 90 or 95%. So in our cohort group, when you look at us from a percentile perspective, we are on the lower side in our group, but it doesn't mean that our patient satisfaction scores are at 20%. It means because we're at 75% in our group, our comparison group, we're right around the 20th, 25th percentile you know, in comparison. So we have, you know, so we have work to do, but it is a great tool for us to use to educate. We have a training room for in our administrative office that is, you know, where people, we help coach people on managing difficult patients and answering the phone and those kinds of things. So it is an important tool for us and that helps us be able to measure where we're at so that we can, you know, work on getting better. Oh, wrap it up. Okay. Go fast, fast, fast. All right. So I will go through this really quickly. This is a bit of our payer mix. Like I mentioned, we're about half Medicaid, and we have opportunity to engage in a Medicaid enhancement program. It's called an UPLIF or state-directed payment program that really allows us to be able to get enhanced revenue from Medicaid. UMC, UNR, and us are all eligible through the state of Nevada for this program. And so it allows us to get closer to the commercial reimbursement rate for our Medicaid patients. Right now, the UPLIFT program is about 12% of our revenue. I will be the first to admit it is a pretty convoluted program. We have a roadmap that we can certainly share with people to explain you know, how we get a bill, we pay the bill, and then we draw down federal dollars through Nevada in order to enhance this. Last year in FY25, the state had under budgeted the amount of money that they were going that they anticipated drawing down from the federal government for the state directed payment program, and so it left us with about a $900,000 deficit in a payment that we were expecting to get that we didn't get. And so they worked collectively with all the groups that are in this program, put in an amendment to the federal government, and then got it approved in the fall. And so our payment that we should have received in FY25, we've received in FY26. And when we were figuring out, when we got the notice that we weren't going to get it in the spring, what we were going to kind of, like, we thought we would get it later. What do we do with that? We worked with Ide Bailey, our auditor, to make sure that we're claiming it in the right year and not the wrong year. And so we did receive that that payment later in the fall, that cash payment. So we're really excited about that. This is just a quick depiction of some of the things that we do and what's happening with reimbursement codes. So this, you know, if you are seeing a doctor in the hospital, doctor in the clinic, you're getting an appendectomy, you're delivering a baby, things are not getting better as far as physician reimbursement. So we're doing everything we can to enroll in these additional payment programs through accountable care organizations, incentive programs, the Medicaid programs, so that we can be able to cover our costs and have a margin. But this really, the facility billing, hospitals and surgery centers, is really where a significant amount of the profit is happening right now. This slide just is a snapshot of the salary expense for UNLV Health, and I think the important parts here to note is that last year the UNLV faculty salary that was paid from UNLV Health to UNLV to cover the salaries was $25.5 million. We're trending a little higher than that this year. That is really in line with our increase in our, you know, in our volume and the increased number of FTEs that we have. The other important part here is to highlight is the increase in the faculty fringe rate and the also major increase in the health insurance for the UNLV Health employees. You know, because they're a 501c3 nonprofit, we have separate retirement. We negotiate health insurance for them with Cragen and Pike. And those costs that most businesses are seeing are really going up. So it isn't definitely an extra cost to the practice. So last year, this is a graph that just shows the last three fiscal years and the first 6 months of the current fiscal year that looks at the UNLV Health expenses and revenues in addition to what our net position was at the end of the year. In FY24, we ended in a, you know, very positive position. You know, that was related to our, you know, our first year into the state directed payment program. And then last year we did close with an operational deficit a lot of, we have about $3.5 million of depreciation and amortization expenses. We've been able to cover all of our expenses, our leases, our salary payments, and we're hoping to be able to close at break even this year. At the end of December, we were about $100,000 in deficit. We talked about, you know, a number of our highlights already, and I know we're a little over on time. As far as future growth, I just want to take a minute and talk about UMC. So we've been working with the leadership at UMC on what, you know, what does our next period look like together so that we can be in alignment. And so we've had a number of meetings. We really understand where what some of their priorities are. They understand what some of our priorities are. And we're meeting again on the 9th of March. And, you know, we're going to be forever partners. And I'm very confident that we will identify the terms of this new agreement. It is likely that we're going to need to look at some different funding opportunities for the sustainability of some of our residency and fellowship programs. And so we're brainstorming and looking what our opportunities are going to be related to that.
Thank you.
And I think that is all we have. I'm happy to take any extra questions. Sorry, we went over a few minutes.
No, you know, I actually, and I had asked Daniel, who's not here, sorry, Daniel, but I had asked this to be a longer item because I knew we had a lot to talk about. So please don't feel bad that you went over. And, you know, with UMC, you know, with Roseman here, with so many things happening, you know, we need to make that work. And I'm just, mm-hmm. I'm thrilled that you're committed to doing that. So thank you. And thank you, President Hebe, for your commitment. And congratulations on your accreditation. And last but not least, stay on Intermountain Health to make sure we get those GMEs, because I think that's vital as we move forward to, I know that it was just put in the lease that there would be discussions. President Hebe knows I wanted more, but I think we should really just make sure that, you know, we, you know, if it's feasible with our new affiliation agreement with yep. UMC, of course. Yep. I don't know if that's even possible, but if it is, I think it's vital that we get access to that. So thank you very much for this very robust presentation. I appreciate your willingness to answer all of the questions. Do any of the other regents have any questions at this time? Okay. Thank you, thanks. Dean Netsky. Thank you. I appreciate you. Okay, sorry that this went a little long, but I did ask for it to be a longer item. UNLV School of Dental Medicine, you have our full attention. Dr. Gerstenberger, we will not pay less attention to you because you're last on the list. We're very excited about your presentation, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you very much.
If I could again make just a brief opening remark, I just really want to thank Dean Gerstenberger. Dean Gerstenberger is a very long time serving Dean of Public Health who stepped in as the acting dean for the School of Medicine very recently. As you know, we've had some leadership transitions there that are related to some of the kind of discussion items that we heard even earlier today. I think we're making great progress, and we're launching a search for a full-time new external, we expect, dean of the School of Dental Medicine as fast as humanly possible. And again, thank you to Dean Gerstenberger for stepping in as acting dean. He's basically running two colleges at once.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Sean Gerstenberger. I'm the acting dean of the UNLV School of Dental Medicine. I know we are a little behind schedule, so I will try to present with brevity and rigor and get through these slides and leave some time for questions at the end. So a few of the priorities for the school that I just want to talk about today. Obviously, we are the only accredited school of dental medicine in the state of Nevada, which I think is a point of pride. The CODA accreditation will be coming forth again in 2028, so we are in preparation with some of the materials required for that. I want to spend a little time talking about our financials today, some of the human resources and employee relations enhancements that we're working on, and probably some of the infrastructure and operations. So one of the things about the School of Dental Medicine, we are now in our 20th year since the graduation of the first class, which happened back in 2006. There are about 80 students that graduate per year. They fall into those two main categories, the DMD, which is the traditional four-year. There's usually around 70 to 75 students in that, and then the DDS, which is a two-year program for internationally trained dentists who can come here and then practice in the United States. So we have been and remain committed to developing a high-quality workforce. And the School of Dental Medicine graduated about 111 students and residents over the last year in infusing that workforce with a lot of areas that are in dental medical shortages. And so this is the largest graduating class that we have had in the school history. So I think that bodes well that it is growing and it has been increasing in size. One of the things I want to highlight here is that student enrollment is very strong, and we are a place of choice where people want to come and go to dental school. We receive around 2,000 applications a year, and only about 75 of those students are admitted into the program. Doing a little quick head math, that's only about the top 4%, right, that are going to get admitted into these programs. So these are high-quality, well-prepared students that come here educated and ready to learn and move to the next step. One of the things that we're very proud of is about half of those class in the individuals that are enrolled in those classes are from the state of Nevada. So they do rise to the top, they get selected, they get admitted, and they become dentists and then hopefully remain here in practice. But given that international and national presence, you can see that we recruit folks from all over the United States, and you can see some of the states and countries there. We'll go with North America anyway, it's Canada, right? So it's a high quality class of students with good enrollment. Similar to what you heard in medicine, there are viable residency programs within the school. We have 47 active residents, and so you'll see advanced education is kind of the term they use here, but that is residency program. And so there's 12 in pediatrics, which was just recently reaccredited, a strong representation in orthodontics, and then also the anesthesia one, which you heard about, which is a collaboration with UMC. And then also there's a dental public health program there as well, which of course is near and dear to my heart, being the dean of the School of Public Health. So one of the notable things here is that the School of Dental Medicine Anesthesia program is relatively new, launched in 2025, and it's really one of the first of its kind that's west of the Mississippi. So I think that's a good innovation. I think I skipped one there. Doesn't matter. So one of the things that has been brought up is the number of positions and vacant positions and how many there are there. So as you can see from the tables up there, there are about 370 employees at the School of Dental Medicine. There's a wide variety of employees there. There are some pretty significant vacancies. There's about 56 openings right now. Over the last few months, we have worked very diligently, and we have posted and are actively recruiting for 17 of those positions. They were not random. They were thoughtfully done with integration and discussion with the leadership teams within the school. Where are the pinch points? Where do we need the most relevant hires done? And I'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide. But that is about 30% of the vacant positions in the school have already been posted, and we are actively searching for those positions. One of the things that we see, too, is there's a lot of part-time instructors that come in, and this is a good thing because they come in and contribute one day a week, take time out of their private practices to give back and train our students. We know they could make a lot more money in their private practices, but they come here because they want to give back. So there's almost 100 folks from the community that come in and do that and take one day a week to work with the School of Dental Medicine. So these are just some of the positions that have posted. I'm not going to read them all to you, but I will hit a few highlights. Some of the director positions in orthodontics and pediatrics, endodontics, which is a very busy area. We have 6 general dentists that are out there. And then one of the reasons I think that the hiring was slowed is because we didn't have anybody left in human resources. So there were 4 vacant positions there. We prioritized those very quickly. We have posted the director position. We have posted the manager position. We've gone through rounds of interviews. And hopefully we'll have somebody hired in there very quickly. So it's difficult to hire when you don't have human resources. A super thank you to the School of Medicine and the main campus who have really stepped in to fill that role. Dr. Nitsky has been very generous with her staff to help us fill positions and help recruit, and we greatly appreciate that. So there's a lot of other priority hires there as well that you can
see.
Quick
question, are you using their HR department?
We are.
Okay.
Yeah, so we use their main campus HR and, of course, some of the folks from the School of Medicine that contribute on search committees.
Okay, great. And Susan Breaker has, yes. Regent Breaker has something really
just
quick.
To follow up to that, and I know I met with you and I appreciate the information and having been extremely familiar with the dental school for many years, but how long have you been using their HR department? Because this is not a six-month issue. This is years, which is unfortunate. And so I want to be polite about it, but it's, yep. I can't imagine the frustration on your side in your brief period of time and the people before you not to have the staff that you need. That's where I'm coming from, so I don't want it to be
yes,
taken.
Yes, that is a fair question. I started late November. We were using them then. I do not know how long they were using them prior to that.
Yeah, President Heavey, Interim President Heavey, for the record, we facilitated that collaboration probably a few months before Dees Gerstenberger came on board. And, you know, to reiterate some of my earlier comments, it was those ongoing challenges that have led the provost and I to make some, you know, changes in the leadership structure to make sure that we were making greater headway on some of these challenges.
So just a quick follow-up, if you don't mind, Chair. So previous to September, how long was that gap? And I know you were not in the position that you're in now.
We'd have to find the exact date.
I don't mean exact, just kind of like how long did it go on going to where it kind of, I don't want to use neglected, but kind of neglected the system.
Well, what I would say is it was a cascade of challenges, and probably be better to tell you some of those things offline.
Perfect.
But there was a sequence of steps that we went
through.
I'm
good with that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Again, Sean Gerstenberger for the record. Just continuing on, we do have some priority hires that were mentioned in the audit that we discussed in earlier meetings. One of those is posted, and the other one is waiting final approval. So we know that those are priority hires as well. But we kind of did have to get the HR team back in place, and so that is one of the priority areas for us. The school does a lot of high-impact research. I'm not going to go into great details on this. I have a few examples on the next slide. But I do want to highlight that there is a wide variety of research that happens there, from clinical innovations to biomedical research to everything in between that improve the patient experience. There are some fascinating titles on this next slide that you can see. I'll just highlight one of them for you. Interesting looking at things like the correlation between marijuana use and dry mouth and how that leads to the increase of acceleration of tooth decay. So one more reason probably not to smoke marijuana, right? So we'll put that one on the list. Sorry, little public health coming out in me there. I apologize. But the School of Dental Medicine, I think, is really a hidden gem in the area of partnerships. They have 40-plus partnerships all over the valley. I won't highlight all of them here as well either, but they are with the community colleges, with Nevada State, and there's a significant outreach program that they do that does oral health education. They have sealant programs that go out into the schools in the community. They do fluoride treatments, and they really span a wide array of partnerships, and if you want more details about any of those, please feel free to reach out to me. We'd be happy to provide that. One of the slides here that I absolutely love the most is this one, and that the School of Dental Medicine serves over 50,000 patients a year all through those building and those walls where we sit right over there in Charleston, which is pretty incredible. I don't think a lot of people are well aware of that. I think it's something that we need to get out there. We need to advertise. We need to market. And the other big piece of that is that these are folks that may not get care anywhere else. It is some of the most marginalized and disenfranchised individuals. There's low rates of insurance. There are primarily some of these areas that are all of our Medicare, Medicaid patients where that is appropriate. And there also are unique programs that serve veterans. They serve women that are in shelters that come out. We also have Saturday clinics for the uninsured that we used to run for quite some time. but due to funding, we've had to cut those back significantly. So some of these folks would have no other place to go. And what they get when they come there is the dignity to come in, get high quality care at a really reasonable price that they may not get anywhere else. And so if you don't remember anything else, I think that is the one take home message that is absolutely incredible. Just want to highlight one of these programs very briefly, don't have time to do them all, but is our pediatrics program. And so what you will see here is this serves, of course, children under the age of 16. 80% of the children that come into this clinic are Medicaid patients. And so you know the Medicaid reimbursement is not the highest reimbursement rate from providers, and but it serves so many individuals in that clinic and does such a service for the community. So we are super proud of that clinic. Very briefly on some of the financials, I'm just going to highlight some of the unique pieces of this. This year is around $7.6 million that is generated in that clinical revenue. You can see the breakdown by the different areas in units. The one that I want to point out that is unique to dental is that predoctoral DMD, DDS that we talked about earlier. So unlike medicine, in dental medicine, you can actually bill for the patient care. That is done by the students. And so the students have certain procedures and exercises they are required to master. And as they move through the program, they go through first simulation laboratory, then on real patients. And when they hit real patients, those are billable expenses that obviously generate about $3 million a year for the school, which is a very unique and exciting resource that we have in that area. So one of the other things that addressing the audit concerns that we had earlier is we did bring on eAssist. This is eAssist Dental Services. They are a third-party firm that will come in and help us with collections. They took us about 13 months to onboard them through this contract. They have been there 3 weeks. They have already gone back and looked at over 1,500 aged bills, and they have looked at the root causes of denials and have now started to look at over $250,000 within the first 3 weeks. So we are very excited to bring them on board. They will work with us on the electronic transfers. They will look at the aging reports. They will look at root causes. They will provide training and improvements internally so that we can get ahead of these things so we don't have denied claims. So we are very excited to have them on board, and we are going to see a really significant improvement in our billing recovery thanks to eAssist. And then last but not least is just some of the capital improvements. You've probably seen on the news and been informed about the Advanced Needs Clinic. I think that's a unique opportunity, but we're also working on some upgrades to our auditoriums. And then one upgrade that I do want to bring up is our SIM Center. So that is the limiting reagent in growth. And so the SIMS laboratory is very heavily used, and the number of stations there will limit the number of students. So we have funding from a grant to increase the number of mannequins, and now we'll have some construction funding. We should be able to increase somewhere between 18 to 22. We're trying to squeeze as many as we can in there so that we could increase the number of students that are admitted to the School of Dental Medicine. So with that, I will stop and be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you so much for that presentation, Regent Breger.
And thank you so much. And like I said, I my visit was interesting and it was nice. What, in regards to the billing component, is that just until you catch up with what had gone on in the past for the past bit of time,
I think we will evaluate that as time goes on. They are a well-known third-party entity that does billing. They will have goals, metrics, and measures for us every month, so the level of increase. But they do add an additional level of support to the staffing that we have internally. So until we can build that staff up and do that on our own, I think eAssist will definitely remain on board.
So would you judge, and I know you're there for, it could be 6 months to a year or whatever it might be, would you judge that against what if we hired someone and benefits and everything else, that this would be much more beneficial to get back some of the lost money? You can only go back so far to the current money that needs to be collected.
Yeah, obviously a lot of those claims age out, you know, 90, 120 days, depending upon the type of insurance. I would hope that we could combine them. I think we need some internal staffing that has oversight of this, that does the reporting and the feedback and the quality control and the compliance pieces, and also that we have an outside entity that does that. I think that will make us stronger when we can combine those two together.
Thank you. And one last question, Chair. When the additional people are hired, and I see 17, I believe, was the number that was up there, that are probably in the works. Do you feel like once they're all back that we could increase our student capabilities, or it will just bring us up to a standard that they're getting the best education they can?
Yeah, I think both of those are true. I think we would, it'll bring us back up. We do need to hire in some areas in accordance with the accreditation criteria. So we need to get those filled, I think, first and foremost. But also we do need to have individuals there to supervise the students and residents in those areas. There is that limiting factor of space. You know, we do have to have enough simulation stations and, of course, enough patients to come into those areas so that they can also see the number of patients, have the right procedures come in so that they can have the appropriate competencies checked off as they move through the degree.
Right. So. And we discussed that it's kind of we don't want everything to be a hidden jewel. But I talk to people all the time, and they're like, oh, I didn't know there was a dental school. So, you know, we talked about a did you know. And maybe UMC could use our resources at the county commission, because they do a did you know all the time. Commissioners do it, and whoever's in that district. It'd be nice if they came and sat in your facility and had a conversation with you or President Heavey or whomever, and I'm happy to work on something like that. But it was a lot of fun when I was there to go to the different entities and share what we really have within our community, and it isn't broadcasted. So I think that would be a nice venue for us to, Marsha's going to write it down, I think, for us to look into, to be able to help with what's happening out there, because we're out there and we're viable and we're good, from the medical school to the dental school to DRI and a lot of other things that maybe the county would enjoy a unique relationship with us. And I think that could be very exciting. I know if I was still there, it'd be something I would do if it was in my district. So I just think it's something to look into to promote that the state of Nevada, not just down here, has an excellent ways. And my dad went there when he was like 90 years old and was so amazed with the treatment and care that he got. He wasn't treated as a age, he was treated as a patient. And that sometimes happens the older you get. So I hope that anyone out there, if you take an elderly parent, treat the disease, not the age.
Right. For the record, John Gerstmer, we would welcome any marketing, branding, communication you could assist us with. We are 100% open to that, and thank you for bringing up that point.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. Again, great knowledge. Lots of things I didn't know. But your company, eAssist, mm-hmm. Now, are they like mercenaries, bounty hunters? They get a percentage of what they bring back, or are we paying them a salary?
For the record, Sean Gerstenberger, yes, we like to think of them as collaborators, but they do, of course, take a percentage. They take 5.5% of the recovered claims. However, if you are leaving a lot of claims on the table and you have those that are aging out, that will pay for itself many, many, many times over in the efficiencies that they bring. And they are very knowledgeable and have years and years of experience and bring teams in to help in these areas.
That's awesome. I'll do it for 5%, but no, that's great to know. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Moving forward, we'll go to item number 7, which is new business. Are there any items for new business? Seeing none, we will move on to public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There's no public comment at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
There's no public comment in Reno.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas? SES, is there any public comment on the phone?
None at this time, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, thank you all. I appreciate your patience during this meeting. I thought it was a very good meeting, and I appreciate it. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.